Welcome back from lunch. Hope you enjoyed the meal and it's a beautiful day. So, I'm going to actually talk about a word that sometimes we don't talk about very much, which is enlightenment. And what does it actually mean? Is it even possible? And what does it have to do with me? So, again, I just want to recognize the brilliance of this tradition, which basically takes, the most challenging things in life, aging, illness, dying, death, and actually gives us the ability not just to sort of tolerate them and accept them, but actually to use them as opportunities. And so the three heavenly messengers are pointers and they're opportunities because our life often distracts us from awakening. But the messengers are direct pointers because what else, if you can't take this body with you, this mind or this personality, what can you take? And so those messengers, aging, illness, and death, really beg the question, what can I take with me when this life ends? And the Buddhist answer is the fourth heavenly messenger, which is awakening. We each have this potential to awaken, to get enlightened, whatever that means. And so it's really, we just want to stop and really just consider this. We have the potential to be truly happy, as I said in the morning, regardless of illness, regardless of aging, regardless of winning the lottery or getting in a car accident. All of those things are circumstances that don't seem to determine our happiness as much as our attitudes towards circumstances determine our happiness. And so this practice is called bhavana, or mental cultivation, which basically means we're cultivating our attitudes, our mind. We always have our mind with us. And we always have an attitude of some kind. And the theory is that changing our attitudes towards our experience is a more sure route to happiness than trying to change the circumstances. Of course, we need to change circumstances when we can. But the more surefire route is by changing our relationship with our experience. And the fact that there's a possibility of awakening can give our life deep meaning. And you don't have to think of it in an abstract way. In a concrete way, don't you want to be more present and aware for your life? How would it be to be just fully present and aware? So whatever taste you've had of the mind quieting down and not assaulting you so much, but just your mind quiets and you kind of just rest in the moment. You're just being, right? So whatever taste of that you've had, you understand there's something very deep and nourishing about it. How would it be to not just be a visitor to that experience, but to actually live there? Would you want that for yourself? Would that be pretty cool? What if you just woke up one day and you couldn't help but be mindful and aware and in the moment? You couldn't help but feel your feet as they hit the floor out of bed. Feel your feet as you walked to the toilet or to the kitchen. You know, you couldn't help but listen and smell and taste and touch and even be aware of your thoughts and emotions. And while you're aware of all of it, it doesn't have the capacity to assault you or define you or limit you, because there's this deep awareness. And when something's over, it's over. There's a story about a really awake teacher in Thailand. I heard when I was in the monastery. I don't remember his name, Ajahn somebody. But some visitor of the monastery just didn't follow protocol at all and was rude and didn't bow when he was supposed to bow and just interrupted the abbot and just was sort of insulting and all that. And then finally, you know, he left. And someone asked the abbot, "Well, that guy sure was rude, you know, like, I can't believe how he insulted you." And the abbot just said, "What's over is over. Like, done." What if your difficulty only stressed you out in the moment of it? And as soon as it was over, it was done. You leave the office, you leave work, work is done for now, for that day. You and your partner have a conflict, and as soon as it's over, it's done. There's no residue. You're just fully living in the moment. And it's not a quality of passivity. It might be peaceful, but it isn't passive. Being fully aware in the moment is very peaceful, but also very responsive. You could be crying one moment and laughing the next moment. It's like you're a child almost. Do you want this for yourself? If you do, then your life has meaning. Just with that, regardless of any other meaning in your life, this can really give your life meaning and purpose. I got this gift of life, and part of what I want to do with the gift is to work on being more and more present and aware, because I know how much that nourishes me and how much I'm more open and more loving and more available to help. So whether you want enlightenment, whatever that means, I'm guessing you really want this, to be more and more present and aware. And the good news is, you can do something about that. You can practice. You can practice formally, come on retreat, sit and walk at home, and you can practice just bringing presence to your life every moment. It gives your life purpose and direction. Why not? Why not really aspire to be more awake? So I will talk about enlightenment, but I want to talk about happiness and enlightenment. Are they the same thing? Yes and no. The happiness that is the Coca-Cola happiness, you know, that depends on opening the bottle and then drinking, and then once the bottle's empty, your happiness is empty. So that is not the happiness of enlightenment, obviously. We could say the happiness of enlightenment, and the Buddha referred to this, is a deep peacefulness. And again, peaceful not in the sense of passive, but peaceful in the sense of at ease, at rest. And it's not a peacefulness apart from life. It's a peacefulness with life as it is, with all the chaos, the messiness, the mistakes, the hurt feelings, you know, all the stuff that happens still happens. It's a peacefulness with it, inside of it. I have a cartoon relates to that somewhere in here. So there's a guy sitting on a porch in the middle of nothing. There's a vulture flying by. It's just a big empty space. I think this cartoonist had done some practice. And then there's a little sign hanging above the man that says, calm in the face of chaos. Not. When we talk about happiness, we're not talking about that, where you just sort of get a break. You have that little lull from conditions, and nothing's very intense. It's not a peacefulness from chaos. It's a peacefulness with chaos, with the mortgage, with the needing to set boundaries for your children, you know, with the heartbreak we go through with children sometimes, with the difficulty of relationships, of work, all of it. You have this internal kind of peacefulness and radiance as you work with the issues of life. The 17th Karmapa came to Boulder a few years ago and spoke over at Mackey. The reincarnation line of Karmapas, they're considered, you know, about as fully awake as a person can get. And the 16th Karmapa taught the Dalai Lama. The 17th Karmapa is a little younger than the Dalai Lama. Not sure if he teaches him yet, but these are very, very awake people, and they reincarnate for the benefit of us. But one of the things he talked about, he said, my life is filled with problems. I have a problem-filled life. Because he's the head of hundreds of thousands of practitioners, monks and nuns and people in the Kagyu tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. He's got to deal with all the politics and the infighting and the this and the that of life. So his peacefulness, his awakeness, isn't apart from any of it. It's right in the middle of all of it. And I suspect he's very okay with all of the problems. So happiness, the happiness of enlightenment is a deep peacefulness and a deep equanimity. Equanimity is you stay balanced as the boat is rocking. It's like the gyroscope that stays steady as the boat is just doing all of its toing and froing. And so enlightenment is a deep, deep happiness that's unconditioned, meaning it doesn't depend on something. It just is, a well-being that just is. So the word enlightenment is nibbana in Pali, and nibbana means extinguished or unbinding. And when the Buddha talked about enlightenment, nibbana, he mostly talked about it in as a negation, because it's very hard to talk about what it actually is. So he used words like the unmade, the unborn, the unoriginated, the cessation of suffering, freedom from longing, the beyond, cessation, the deathless. So these are sort of all the things that it isn't. And then another way of thinking about it is it's the complete absence of reactivity in your mind. And reactivity has a very specific sense in the Buddhist tradition. It's specifically talking about the reactions of greed for the pleasant, aversion for the unpleasant, and ignorance of the neutral. And the word the Buddha used for it was craving or tanha. And he said craving is the cause of our suffering. That's the second noble truth. The first noble truth, there is suffering. The second noble truth, craving is the cause. Greed, aversion, and delusion are essentially arguments with reality. It's taking the feeling tone we've been working with and being reactive to it. So our reaction with pleasant is greed. We grab it and we don't want it to go away. And then that's painful because pleasant does go away and unpleasant or neutral comes. But we're still stuck on the pleasant and we suffer. So awakening is the absence of reactivity. It's not having that relationship with feeling tone. It's being able to simply be equanimous when there's the noise of traffic. If you're finding the noise of cars unpleasant, I advise you strongly, if you remember in the instructions, I said, tease out pure sound from your thoughts or images about it. And see which is the feeling tone that's bothering you. I had an experience on a tree where there was an instruction given to not breathe loudly in the hall. And if you could hear yourself breathing, then you were breathing too loud, because it can be distracting to people. So I sort of took that and ran with it. And the person next to me was breathing really loudly. And I had aversion. It was unpleasant. And I just meditated a lot with, give me a break. Like, this is a mindfulness retreat. Are you listening to what they're saying? If you can hear your breathing, it's too loud, and I can hear your breathing, so it's got to be too loud, and I'm getting in all my judgment and this and that. Very reactive, very aversive. When I watched my experience, I noticed the sound of the man's breathing was really sort of neutral. The unpleasantness was my judgment. I couldn't believe this person, like, didn't listen. And so I felt very judgmental and negative, and that was the really unpleasant part. It wasn't the sound. And so when I talked to one of my teachers about it, you know, I said, if I really am honest with myself, the sound isn't any different than, like, a radiator. I wouldn't react to a radiator. So my teacher says, yeah, well, just when you hear the sound, just note radiator. And then it's just sound. it's not all of our construct that we put on top of it. So as we work with feeling tone today, you'll start to notice some of these distinctions. Sound is just sound, even if it's unpleasant. We don't have to be reactive. And we can drop greed, aversion, and delusion. So we get that we can have greed or desire for the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant. But the reaction of delusion or ignoring neutral is when we don't even know we have, because we don't even know neutral is here. Neutral's everywhere, you know? Without looking down, what color is the carpet? Did you notice that? It's probably very neutral. And ego in us really doesn't like neutral. Neutral is sort of like death, almost. Ego, of course, wants pleasant, number one. But we will take unpleasant way more than we would want neutral. Ego loves a problem. If you have a problem, you get to exist. Ego gets to exist. And so there can be this sort of subtle attachment to all of our difficulty, because it seems to sort of create a me and an I. Whereas neutral is just, what's neutral? You know, neutral is just like, do I even exist if there's neutral? So, you know, we will take Tabasco any day over just like brown rice or mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes is, you know, unless you put all that stuff in it, which we now do, bacon, cheddar, broccoli, mashed potatoes, right? Then it's getting into something. But just brown rice, mashed potatoes, neutral. So we ignore it. And the Buddha said that too is a reactive relationship in the sense that it's just not aware. We're not aware in our greed. We're not aware in our aversion, and we're not aware in our delusion of the neutral. So awakening, this is the Theravada definition, is the complete absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. And that's the root of all of our reactivity. All of our reactivity is some flavor of this. So fear, anger, irritation, jealousy, it's all a form of aversion. So this is really the nub of it. And our reactivity is to feeling tone. When you look at any situation, difficulty at work, a health challenge, a family problem, any situation is going to boil down to that you're struggling with a reactive response to feeling tone. Your teenager is so unpleasant. And you're so aversive. So the Buddha made it very clear and simple. The root of it. This is at the root of it. And so enlightenment is, you can't even, there's not even the potential for greed, aversion, or delusion. So you get a diagnosis from the doctor. A fully awake person, in theory, gets that diagnosis of cancer. There's no aversion. There's no fear. Hard to imagine, right? And yet, awakening happens. So it is possible. So this is kind of the Theravada sense of enlightenment. It's not the only sense. The Tibetan tradition doesn't define it this way. And I practice in the Dzogchen tradition, which is kind of the non-dual form of the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And in the Dzogchen tradition, awakening is defined simply as an experience of pure awareness, without effort, without focus. There's just pure presence, pure awareness. There's no meditator doing it. And when our practice with our effort deepens, there are times when sometimes we can taste a kind of effortless awareness, where the practice is strong enough to where you don't even have to try anymore. You just are mindful. And then that experience, when you really get used to it, is their sense of what enlightenment is. And they have a sense in this tradition of you recognize, they call it the nature of mind. The nature of mind is pure awareness. And so there's two stages in its most simple form. The two stages are recognizing the nature of mind as pure awareness. And that's a very deep, life-changing experience. And then the rest of your life is phase two, which is stabilizing the recognition that you who you are is pure awareness, which just means abiding in the state of pure awareness. Now, it just, you know, greed, aversion, and delusion don't happen in that state of pure awareness. So you can put the two together, but the Dzogchen tradition is much more focused, the practice, on orienting to the fact that pure awareness is actually happening if you're not distracted from it. It's not really our tradition, but I just want to sort of give you a sense of how it's a very different understanding of enlightenment. So believe it or not, with those two points of view, then within Theravada Buddhism, which is Southeast Asia, so Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka are the main countries where you find Theravada Buddhism, which is, it's oversimplifying to say this, but I'll say it. It's sort of more like the original Buddhism taught by the Buddha, that Zen and Tibetan are kind of later developments of the tradition. So if you study in the Thai forest tradition of Theravada Buddhism, they have this understanding of pure awareness. And you can hear teachers talk about, here's Ajahn Mahabua, who's considered a very awake master in Thailand. What he says is, this vanishes, that vanishes, but that which knows they're vanishing does not vanish. All that remains is simple awareness, utterly pure. So his language is sort of in that pure awareness mode. So you know, if you work with monks or nuns in the Thai forest tradition, you'll hear this kind of language. In Burma, this would be bashed. They talk about nibbana as cessation. It's not actually pure awareness. Pure awareness is maybe a very important element of the path, but it's not nibbana. Nibbana is cessation. It's just the end of greed, aversion, and delusion. And you can't really say anything else about it. So, what is awakening? Well, depends who you talk to. And the controversy is basically conceptual mind trying to understand non-conceptual reality. there's always going to be confusion if we're thinking, because thinking can't capture reality. It can only sort of approximate it. So, controversy, it's okay. So a third way to think about awakening, so we have the end of greed, aversion, delusion, sort of classical Theravada. We have an understanding of pure awareness coming out of the non-dual Dzogchen tradition of Tibet. You could think of it, this is you read this a lot, that awakening is the dropping the delusion that you're a separate self. You're unique, you're distinct, in the sense that when you bang your knee into a cabinet by accident, no one else feels your pain, only you do. So you're distinct. But we take our uniqueness and our distinctness and then pervert it into this belief that we're a separate self. That I am over here and everything else is over there. I'm separate, and that the essence of me is unchanging. There's the same little mini-me inside of me that's here now, was here when I was in college, was there when I was 4 years old, heck, was even there as an infant. What about as a fetus? That, if you really look at our belief, that's what we believe. There's something, some essence in here that hasn't changed. Even though, hint, hint, all you've ever done is change your entire life. Your thoughts change, your body changes, your mood changes. You know, if you look, read science about what's happening in your body, thousands of cells are dying and being recreated right now as you're listening to this sentence. You are a froth. I am a froth, but our senses don't perceive it. But scientifically, we know this to be true. But we do watch our thoughts change all day long, our emotions change, our sensations change. And yet, we still have this belief. It's sort of like a superstition that we're this separate self. And so awakening is seeing fully through that delusion to realize I'm here, but I'm not here as its separateness. In fact, I belong. I belong deeply to creation. I am literally, because of the food I ate today, I literally am made up of air and water and soil and sunlight. It's not poetic. The plants inside you right now that your stomach and intestines are magically converting into nutrition is the universe. And is the food in your stomach right now you? It's not rhetorical. If you had to, you could throw it up, right? So is it you? No? And what about what's in your large intestines? Yeah, right. Is that you? The small intestine takes out the nutrients. The colon is largely there to take out excess water. Is it you? It's in your body. Isn't this body me? How could what's be in my body not be me? Oh, I get it. So I eat the universe, and it's just the universe inside of me. Right, but when it crosses the GI tract into my bloodstream, then it's me, magically. So everything, you have to map the entire GI tract, everything inside the GI tract isn't me, and everything on the other side of it is me. You see the fallacy in it, right? Our ideas do not match reality. And so literally the thought you're having right now and the awareness you're having right now is fueled not by you, but by the universe. Literally, biologically, non-poetically, it's the universe listening right now in a unique, distinct filter that you label me. And so when your attention gets really, really refined and really mindful, you start watching the creation of me. We create it with our thoughts and images and our felt sense that there's a me here. But any thought that I'm a me can't be me, because thoughts change all the time. The minute you think of Australia, you is obliterated. So the self cannot rely on an idea that I'm a self. And our mindfulness sees through this. And it's a huge relief to get it that I am everything. And it sounds like such a cliche, but it's actually factual. And we feel so much better when we drop this notion of separateness. Everything you know, that you've learned in your life used to be outside of you, and now it's inside of you. Someone taught you 2 + 2 = 4. You didn't know that once. Someone taught you the alphabet. That was outside of you. But now that you know it, now it's me. It's sort of like the way the food crosses the GI tract. We do this sort of magical thing of, oh, now it's me. I learned that. I can read and write. So Thich Nhat Hanh, he likes to hold up a piece of paper and say, this is a cloud. Because of the water that fed the tree, that created the wood, that got harvested and mulched and pulped into paper. This is a cloud. This paper is made of non-paper elements. You are made of non-you elements. Physically and mentally, everything you learned was non-you, and now it's you. So, this is a cloud, and so are you. So, we love it when we see through this veil of separateness and see that it's a creation of mind. It's relentless. It's happening all day long. Every time you speak, you do it. I'm happy, I'm sad. Right? We create self through language. But it's not the reality of your experience. When you really become mindful, you see that, oh, when I'm listening just to sound or feeling just sensation, there isn't a me. Until I have the idea, there's a me. But the me can't be an idea, because ideas change. So this is the third way to think about enlightenment. The complete seeing through the delusion of separateness. And we're so happy when we see through that. We belong. So there's so much more to say about that, but I'm going to leave that aside now. Three different perspectives on awakening. Mindfulness is the practice. It doesn't matter how you define it. Mindfulness takes us there to any of these ways you look at it. This is where mindfulness is taking us. So, is it real? Is it possible, this awakening? I want you to be able to build on your own common sense to answer the question for yourself. And this is what you can see from your experience. If we say that awakening is this dropping of reactivity. We've all experienced that. We all know we have a time where instead of our usual reaction, we actually sort of stop and are just simply curious and aware of the situation. What if it's as simple as, in your practice this morning, you felt some pain in the body, or maybe there was an itch. Instead of moving or scratching, you just turn your attention to the pain itself, the unpleasantness. And you were actually sort of okay. You didn't need to scratch the itch because you were just really interested in the itch itself. What's it like? Oh, it's like this. Is it big? Is it small? Is it changing? You're in a different relationship with it. Instead of a reactive relationship, you're in a curious relationship. And the basic idea of the practice, if I could put what we're practicing in one sentence, the essence of it is, we are replacing reacting to feeling tone with being mindful of it. Period. If you want to take home a sentence about the Buddhist path, that is a one-sentence summary. Anyone want to try to say it so you can take it home? You want to try?
Say it again.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to say it again?
Yes,
okay, I'm going to say it again, and then I want you to say it.
Okay.
The essence of our practice, or let's say it this way. Yeah, no, I'll say it that way. The essence of our practice is that we are replacing reacting to feeling tone with being mindful of it.
With a sense of humor added.
With a sense of humor. That leads to a big sense of humor.
Yeah.
It does. Because being reactive is very serious. But being non-reactive is very light. Okay, what are the three reactions we have to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? Yeah. So you can remember it, GAD to PUN. All right? GAD is greed, aversion, delusion. PUN is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So our basic problem is we do GAD to PUN. So the essence of our practice is what?
Replacing. Reacting to feeling tone, being mindful of it.
Perfect. Anyone else want to say it? The essence of our practice is
replacing reacting to feeling tone with being mindful.
Nice. That's it. Do you buy the hype?
Yes.
Is this possible for you? Nice. You can do this, right? You can have a moment where instead of being pissed off about your knee pain, you're curious about it. That is, in a nutshell, the entire path. You understand enlightenment if you understand that. And then your job, if you really want to get enlightened, is to become an Olympian-level meditator. So that's the bad news. The good news is this isn't hard to understand in your own experience. You can extrapolate. If I can do that with an itch, and I can even do that with a difficult emotion like irritation or restlessness, oh, wow, that was cool. Instead of freaking out about being restless, I started to really notice what it was like. And somehow, weirdly, I ended up being okay with it. If you've had that experience, you understand enlightenment. You just take that experience and you get better at it. And the way you get better at it is by practicing. That's why we call it practice. You keep practicing. And it seems like a little small thing you're doing, but you're only solving the entire human conundrum, which is how do I learn to be happy with the play of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral? PUN will never stop. Feeling tone will never stop. It doesn't matter how successful, rich, good-looking, young, talented you are, your life is still pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It never stops. The Buddha died of food poisoning after being awake for 40 years, 45 years. His life was still pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, but it didn't bother him. He already was happy. The play of feeling tone didn't assault him because he was so mindful. The better you get at mindfulness, the less feeling tone assaults you. Because we somehow are built to where mindfulness makes us okay. We're already okay. There's a joke going around when in the 2008 crash, the joke was something like, I got a credit card offer in the mail. It was pre-declined. Saved me a lot of trouble. So we can flip that and say, well, if it was pre-disapproved, it's like we're pre-okay. We're already okay. So an unpleasant experience comes along, and instead of you freaking out about it, you're like, interesting. What's this like? That's the essence of awakening. Curiosity instead of reactivity. Simple, right? Possible? To get less reactive through more mindfulness? Is that possible for you? Then maybe so is awakening. So is waking up. It just means doing more and more and more. And remember what we talked about at the very beginning. Of course you want to be really present and really aware. It's not the product that we struggle with. It's the path. It's the fact that it takes work. And then we think we don't want it, and we forget that we do want it. And it does take work. That's the problem. It's possible. We can see it. We all understand this. And we want it. But we forget because it's too much work. Wouldn't awakening be worth a little work? Maybe a lot of work? I mean, think of how hard you work at all the trivial stuff. Making sure your lawn is fertilized, you know? I don't know. There's a crack in your driveway. You gotta get the asphalt guys in there, right? We work really hard at a lot of stuff. Why don't we work really hard at this? There's some reasons. here's one of them. The doctor to his patient is saying, we found this in your brain, and it's a little organ grinder monkey. So one of our problems with awakening is meditation frustrates us because of our monkey mind. And now neuroscience has proved we do have a monkey in our brain that you'll just see in the cartoon. You sit down, you've got monkey mind. This is hard. Oh, frustrated. You sit down and the billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles. Oh my God. I cannot do this. This is boring. This is stupid. I'm so sick of my mind. So we have that. We don't like that. This cartoon, we have this unruly monkey mind. This is the first day of Zen Garden School. And the senior monk is sitting there like this with his head in his hand because one person in the sand is doing a snow angel. One monk is building a little sand castle. Another monk has stepped on a rake and has hit his face. Another monk seems to be burying some treasure. So this is what it's like in our minds. This is hard for us. It's not easy to do this practice. Here's another meditation cartoon. Hulk is meditating in beautiful full lotus posture. And he's saying, Hulk, no smash. Hulk, no smash. Hulk, maybe smash a little. So we have our impulses and our tendencies, and we have to sit with those, and that's hard. So our path is very hard, and then it's got weird concepts like karma. And so then you're faced with a choice. If you really had to choose two women jogging, which would it be, enlightenment or buns of steel? So. The problem with this path, we can lay it out really simple and clear like this, but then we have to do it. And it's hard. Let's be real. This isn't easy. Our minds are restless. You know, they go all over the place. We get frustrated with our practice. It seems like it should be so easy, and it's not. So then you have to remember, oh, right, I am only completely going against the human condition. And I'm only, you know, solving the human condition. So any practice you do is fantastic because it's got such power. And so maybe it is buns of steel you're after, and that's what this life is for. But if you're here today, I have a sense that you know you might even get those buns of steel. But then you reach age 70, or age 75, or age 80, and it takes 8 hours a day to keep those buns of steel. And you can't do it. You have to let go. So since you're gonna let go later, why not just let go now? And just accept this aging body. And then you have more time for practice. I want to just read a quote. Because we don't have to go for awakening. I mean, you know, I'm not here to tell you should do this. As a compassionate thought, I would want you to. I would want me to. But then life intervenes. And life does something to you, and you realize, you know what? I really have to get my ducks in a row. Time is short. It is only running out. And this is a precious gift. And I really want to be more present and aware. I really want this for myself. So Bhante Gunaratna said this, "You can't ever get everything you want. It is impossible. Luckily, there's another option. You can learn to step outside the endless cycle of desire and aversion. You can learn not to want what you want, to recognize desires but not be controlled by them. You want something, but you don't have to chase after it. You fear something, but you don't have to stand there quaking in your boots." This mental cultivation is very difficult. It takes years. But trying to control everything is impossible. The difficult is preferable to the impossible. So, I'll stop with that and see if you have any input, questions, or comments.
Definitely.
Please.
So, how would you distinguish pleasantness from happiness?
How would I distinguish pleasantness from happiness? Well, pleasantness is a quality of an experience. A pleasant sound, a pleasant odor, a pleasant thought. Happiness is a mood, right? It's a state of mind or heart. And happiness is pleasant. It has its own feeling tone, which is pleasant. So
we're just going for pleasant.
Well, Buddhism believes we have an unrelenting drive for well-being. The point of this practice is well-being, but it's based on reality. To base your well-being only on pleasantness is insecure, because it's only one slice of the three-slice pie. So happiness is the point, but it's a reliable happiness, not an insecure one.
It's separated from feeling.
Yes. Yeah. Happiness can be our response to feeling tone. But again, with mindfulness, we can be happy when it's unpleasant. So happiness doesn't have to be coupled with pleasure. I don't know, you can have a guilty pleasure where maybe it doesn't lead to happiness because you feel really kind of bad about it. So happiness and pleasure are not like locked together.
I found it useful to consider the word joy instead of happiness. And I think that even your topic today was unconditional happiness, or was it
mm-hmm. unshakable happiness?
Unshakable, yeah. So either unshakable or unconditional joy, because I think that can be our views, our ground of our state of being is joyfulness. When we're in that equanimous state, we're not. We are mindful. There's a state of being alive that's joyful. And part of what you bring to practice, and what I really enjoy, is your lightness. And you know, all the enlightened ones, Dalai Lama and Tutu and all of them, they all have a lightness of being.
Yes. But let me, just one little interjection in response to that. I just read this the other night. This is in a book by Daniel Goleman called Altered Traits, about how the states of meditation over time lead to the traits, like just it's who we are physically, you know. It's a trait, it's no longer a passing state. And anyway, he just in passing was talking about the Dalai Lama. Someone asked him, what's been the happiest moment of your life? And he said, this one, I think. Can you imagine? Because someone could have asked him that at any time. But that's what was his answer when they asked him that. So maybe he's just living there. I hope.